Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The latest pandemic news has taken a bit of an upward turn. Experts are suggesting we've passed the peak of the Delta variant of COVID-19, and infection and hospitalization rates are slowly but surely diminishing. This is attributable to mass vaccination, some natural immunity developed from the nearly 45 million Americans that have tested positive for the coronavirus, and the fact that school children are masking up again and their infection rates have also plateaued. My guest today has had a front row seat to all of the events of the last 2 years as a doctor, a researcher, and a board member of Pfizer, the pharmaceutical giant that makes one of the highly safe and effective COVID vaccines. Scott Gottlieb also served as commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration from 2017 to 2019. Upon stepping down, he's become a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a healthcare venture capitalist, and a frequent commentator on aspects of the pandemic such as preparedness, resource allocation, and supply chain efforts. He has a new book reflecting on America's failures to stem the pandemic and recommendations on how we can avoid future infectious calamities. The book is called Uncontrolled Spread: Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic, and it's just out from Harper. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, welcome to Medical Monday. Your book, Uncontrolled Spread, I have to say, I mean, it's incredibly detailed, very well written, but it's painful. It's like reading a yearbook of misery. I guess it was reawakening some trauma from the pandemic. I mean, reading through all of the intricacies, and I mean, you really have an inside seat to what was going on at all levels of government and, you know, certainly including the White House. I'd like to start sort of where you start the book, where we learn about the pandemic in China. Why do you think it is that the Chinese government, it was very much a repeat, it seems like, of the SARS epidemic from, I guess, 2001 or 2002, where they really were reluctant to release information and kind of a global sharing to try to stem. That could have been something that stopped this from becoming a pandemic. I mean, why did they do that?
Well, you know, some of this was the fog of viral war. I mean, we need to sort of understand when did the Chinese government really fully understand that an epidemic was underway inside China. And I think that there was withholding of information at the provincial level from Chinese central authorities. There's now some evidence that even people in sort of central Beijing weren't aware of what was underway early enough. But there clearly were things that the Chinese government didn't do that they could have done, and information that they could have surfaced that could have helped the world better prepare. And I don't know the answer to the question why they didn't share that information. You know, they knew earlier than they shared it, certainly weeks earlier than they shared it, that there was person-to-person transmission because they had evidence of infected healthcare workers. By the time they disclosed that, they had a dozen or so healthcare workers already infected. They didn't become infected overnight. They became infected over the course of a week or two. They had that information earlier. So they had evidence of asymptomatic transmission. We now know that doctors were seeing asymptomatic spread or indications of asymptomatic spread. That really wasn't disclosed until mid-January. They were late to share the sequence data. I mean, they were publicly, you know, congratulated for sharing the sequence data. It was shared by a researcher who effectively went rogue and shared it on his own, and he was reprimanded for it. He had his lab shut down after he had shared it through an Australian colleague. They still, to this day, haven't shared the source strains of the virus. And so, you know, there was a certain aspect of this that probably in mid-December, information wasn't flowing effectively through China. So the central Chinese government wasn't aware of what was fully underway in the Hubei province. But certainly by the end of December and into early January, that information was making it up to the top. And then there was still a deliberate withholding of information. So you had this situation where information was suppressed at the provincial level. And then when it started to flow up to the central government, it underwent further suppression at that level. And I don't know why this happened. All I know is, and you know, what I conclude is we can't be dependent upon other nations just willingly sharing information in the future. If we want to better prepare ourselves going forward, we're going to have better mechanisms in place for gathering information. And that means getting our tools of foreign intelligence engaged in this global public health mission. And that's a much different posture than we've taken in the past, where we've largely relied on open sharing and cooperation to surface these kinds of outbreaks.
I want to focus a little bit on the CDC, which so much has been said and written about. But you sort of take them to task a little bit because there seemed to be this really early on in the pandemic. I mean, before we were acknowledging or even the World Health Organization acknowledged that COVID-19 or even had I guess, name the illness from the SARS-CoV-2 virus, testing was a real problem. And rather than sort of letting testing occur sort of through the private sector or in research labs or fully in the private sector with, you know, so Quest or LabCorp, the CDC really sort of retained kind of control. And there was a, as I understand it, I guess from your book, there was a reluctance to let university labs. And you point out, like in Seattle, where some of the earliest cases and earliest evidence of community transmission occurred, the University of Washington could have alerted the public of the fact that there was community spread, or in fact that people were testing positive for, you know, what was COVID-19, but they weren't allowed to do so. I mean, what was, can you just recapitulate some of that for us? I mean, why was that so complicated? And I know you don't necessarily know the motivations, but it was a complex problem, to say the least.
Yeah, so the bigger problem was we were playing off of our sort of standard approach to rolling out a diagnostic test in the setting of a public health emergency, which has CDC maintaining tight control over the test and the testing, rolling out a test initially running the test at CDC, then rolling it out to the public health labs. And if that isn't sufficient to keep up with the public health demand, you then make it available to the clinical laboratories like the academic hospitals. And if that still isn't enough, you turn to the commercial manufacturers. And so early on, we just followed that standard playbook without recognizing that in the setting of a fast-moving epidemic where diagnostic testing was going to be essential to controlling the epidemic, that was too slow of a process. And we needed an all-of-the-above approach right from the outset. So CDC prevented academic labs from getting in this game. And Washington State had a test. They were using a test. They were diagnosing cases, and they were shut down effectively. And the cases that they were diagnosing, they weren't allowed to notify the people because they didn't have proper informed consent, because they had conducted a test as a research, used the test as a research tool rather than for diagnosing patients. And so, and then we didn't turn quickly enough to a commercial manufacturer to scale the development of tests once CDC ultimately had a test design. So we got behind the eight ball early, not having enough testing in place to diagnose the early cases, to recognize the community transmission. And by the time we had testing in place, it was too late. The virus was everywhere, and we weren't going to be able to use testing as a tool to try to contain the spread. And that's when we had to reach for the population-wide mitigation, the broad shutdowns, because we weren't able to diagnose where the cases were, and we weren't able to diagnose where they weren't. Part of the problem is that our pandemic playbook always envisioned that the pandemic would be with a flu. And in the setting of influenza, having a diagnostic test widely deployed isn't as important. For one reason, because the incubation period for flu is shorter. People come into contact with flu and get sick from it in a much shorter period of time, and they're usually not contagious until they're infectious. So diagnosing people when they're sort of asymptomatic and carrying the infection to take them out of circulation and diagnosing them before they develop symptoms isn't as important in the setting of controlling a flu as it is for this virus, as it turned out to be for this virus. And the second reason is that our installed base of testing for flu is pretty ubiquitous. You know, if you have a pandemic flu circulating, you don't need to test people and determine that they have that particular strain of flu. So you're not going to need to do PCR testing. All you're going to have to do is determine that they have influenza A or influenza B. And then you're going to conclude that if the pandemic is a strain of influenza A and the patient has influenza A, they have the pandemic strain because that's the strain that's circulating. So all the installed base of rapid flu testing that's in every doctor's office is sufficient for that. It could differentiate influenza A from influenza B, and that would be good enough. So we never really thought of the diagnostic and the ability to rapidly deploy a diagnostic widely and deploy testing as an essential component of the pandemic planning. So when you go back and look at all the tabletop exercises that we ran on how we would, you know, prepare for a pandemic, the pathogen we always prepped was flu, and diagnostic testing was never, you know, top of the list because it would be provided for and it wouldn't be as important. So we didn't adequately plan for this, and nobody recognized early enough in January that, you know, nobody said, hey, we really need to mass deploy a diagnostic test. If someone had said that in January, we could have had ample testing by February, but we really didn't say that until February, and we didn't have ample testing until March.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Scott Gottlieb. He's former FDA commissioner from 2017 to 2019. He's a contributor to CNBC, and he's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's author of the brand new book, Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. I want to ask you specifically about masks, because that has been something that is a confusing issue, or was confusing early on, and has become politicized. And you write about that as well, pretty in depth. And actually, you are part of a, I don't know what the right phrase is, a consensus report or a study group that looked at this issue of masking, both in terms of its ability to stanch the spread of this contagious illness, but also given the fact that our supply chain had been disrupted. And you came out, you and the team you were with came out and said, you know, cloth masks are very viable here. And yet we were very ambivalent, even from the get-go. In fact, our leading national health authorities at first gave the recommendation that we didn't need masks before they kind of pivoted and said, oh, no, we do need masks. But you reveal in the book, which this was really sort of painful to be reminded of, that, in fact, many authorities thought, well, you know, wearing masks may be counterproductive because Americans aren't used to them. They're going to touch their masks a lot. They're going to touch their faces or their eyes, and it's going to wind up spreading the illness more. Whereas other countries were much more comfortable, whether it's cultural or not, just, you know, having their folks wear masks, and it seemed to work in other countries.
Yeah, so I was part of a group of public health experts, a number of them at Johns Hopkins, very good epidemiologists, and we came up with a set of recommendations about reopening, and one of them was around mask wearing, and we ultimately made a recommendation around wearing cloth masks because we had done some work to talk to the intermediaries in the supply chain and concluded that there was a shortage of medical masks. And the original premise of the mask recommendation was that we knew that a lot of the transmission was through asymptomatic people who were out and about, didn't know they were infected, you know, weren't trying to be negligent. They didn't feel sick. They didn't know they were infected, but they were spreading the virus. And what we knew from the literature was that if everyone had a mask on when they went out, even a cloth mask, it would reduce transmission. And we had literature showing that in the setting of influenza, if everyone's masked, it reduces transmission by up to 50%. And so the premise wasn't that a cloth mask was going to protect you from getting infected, although it does offer some protection. The premise was that if you had a mask on and you were contagious, you were going to be less likely to infect someone else. And so if we put masks on everyone, those people who would be likely to go on and pass the infection would now be substantially less likely. And for that purpose, the cloth mask was sufficient. But we know that cloth masks are about, you know, 20% protective for you. Like, so if you're with someone who doesn't have a mask on, you have a cloth mask on, you can postulate that you'll have about 20% reduction in your risk. A good high quality, you know, level 3 medical mask reduces your risk by 40%, and an N95 mask reduces your risk by 95%. So that was the initial premise of the masks. We had discussions with the coronavirus task force, and they ultimately came around to that recommendation, but initially they were hesitant. And the reason that was transmitted to me in terms of their hesitancy was this was a time when they were making a recommendation to people that you should try to stay home. You shouldn't go out. And they felt that if they went out with a recommendation saying people should wear masks, it was saying you should stay home, but you can go out with a mask. And they felt that would be sending a confusing message to the public, that at a time when they were telling people to stay home, if they told everyone to wear masks, that was basically saying stay home, but go out and wear a mask. And so they were reluctant to come out with that advice about the masking. Ultimately, they came around to it. But finishing the thought, it's important to remember where the mask discussion started and where it ended up. So a lot of the criticism and opposition to masks was people who said, masks don't really protect me. You're telling me to wear a mask and it's not going to protect me. But we need to remember the original premise of the mask wasn't that it was necessarily going to protect you. It was going to protect other people from you. And if you wanted to be protected yourself, it was important to wear a high quality mask. And that's why I always talked about the quality of the mask, and that, you know, it's important to get higher quality masks on high risk people. And we should be doing more to try to get N95 and KN95 masks to vulnerable people, including the elderly. Quality of mask mattered if you wanted to derive protection from the mask. A high quality cloth mask can still offer you protection, but it's not going to offer you nearly as much protection as an N95 mask.
Now, you were in the White House as an advisor, or you were actually called by President Trump, who you worked for, and asked about your opinion on masks. And you thought at one point you were going to give sort of a briefing and try from some of his aides, I guess, who invited you in to encourage him to wear masks. But in fact, it sounded like he was already there and he actually wanted to know your opinion about some other things. But you're very clear in the book, and you give President Trump more credit than I think he gets in a lot of quarters for his handling of the pandemic. You make the point that he really knew what was going on, But he did have, you do sort of take him to task a little bit on mask wearing, that he was counterproductive in terms of, you know, his coronavirus task force was saying, go ahead, please do wear masks. And he sort of said, well, yeah, you know, do it. And but he didn't really want to be seen with masks. And I guess from other sources you quote is, you know, he just really didn't like the look of them and he didn't want people in photographs wearing masks. And you know, you talk about different White House events where people really weren't taking those distancing or wearing mask precautions. It would have been nice if our, you know, our messaging on it was consistent and our government officials were indeed, you know, sort of role modeling the behavior that they wanted us to achieve. I mean, is there, you know, anything more you can say about that? Or is, you know, did I summarize it okay?
No, look, I think the summary is good. I would just tweak it slightly. And, you know, I met with the president early on, right before they announced the 15 days to slow the spread and then the 30 days to slow the spread. So I think, you know, people are critical of the president and say he didn't take this seriously and forget early on the president implemented or, you know, agreed to a 45-day shutdown, national shutdown. I mean, an extraordinary decision, right? So that's an indication that they were sufficiently alarmed by the grave risk that this posed that they were willing to take dramatic action. They worked with Congress to pass the $1 trillion stimulus plan. And when I met with the president, it was right before they made that announcement, and some of his advisors before the meeting wanted me to, you know, sort of lay out the case for the mitigation. And when I met with him, my feeling was in that meeting, and I related in the book, was he was already there. They didn't need me to sell the plan. The president seemed already signed on to it. And in fact, after that meeting, later that day, he went out and made an announcement that was sort of a prelude to what they would announce days later, which was a 15 days to slow the spread. I think, you know, where I'm critical of the administration is that, you know, other than like specifically around the masks and some other very specific things, I think where the weakness was we didn't stick with it. You know, we needed a sort of constant action. We needed to have, this was going to be a long fight and we were going to be in it for a while. And we had to have a plan for dealing with this as a pervasive risk. And that didn't mean shutting down the country for a year. We were never going to do that. We should never contemplate that. It wasn't on the table. But we needed to find some way to put downward pressure on the spread until we could get to a vaccine and mass inoculate the population, to keep the healthcare system from being overwhelmed, to try to preserve life, just to keep this from becoming a very pervasive epidemic. And I think by the end, you know, they had given up on a lot of these simpler interventions that we could reach for that would put some downward pressure on this. You know, wearing masks. We can argue over how beneficial masks are, but properly worn, high quality masks, they were going to have some impact on spread. You know, trying to get collective action around reducing high risk activities and high risk settings. Don't crowd 50 people in a small room for a social activity. Try to do things outdoors rather than indoors. There were just some things that we could have done that would have reduced risk overall, probably slowed the spread, wouldn't have prevented, you know, the virus from spreading, but would have put some obstacles in front of it that we needed to galvanize around. And that never really materialized. We never really kind of came together around a commonly agreed upon, you know, set of measures that we could take that wouldn't shut down the economy, would allow us to continue doing what was important to us, but would help slow the spread of the virus. And that's where I think, you know, we could have used sort of the bully pulpit of the White House to get common action around a common set of ideas. But, you know, ultimately there was a perception, and I talk about this in the book, that we really weren't going to be able to stop the spread, that it was going to continue to spread. This is a virus and it was going to continue to spread in an uncontrolled fashion. And anything we tried to do to slow it down was just going to be all cost with no benefit. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think there are things we could have done that would have been less intrusive, that if we all did them together and we got pretty good compliance around it, not 100%, you're never going to get everyone to do something all the time, we could have impacted this. Ultimately, we did. I mean, we were there as a country. I mean, but there was a lot of dissension around those steps. I mean, and it varied a lot regionally. As you saw, the virus have a much different experience regionally, with regional outbreaks in places where there was less compliance versus places where there was more. And we didn't really align around a common strategy.
A couple things that were really fascinating to me in this book I want to share with listeners. For one thing, you taught me that the United States of America has a strategic chicken stockpile. I don't know if that's still true or not, but tell us why that occurs and what it's for goodness sake.
Yeah, it's still true. It's less secretive now than it was at one point. But there was always concern. This comes out of the pandemic planning around 2005, when we were planning for the risk of a pandemic with an avian flu, H5N1 flu. And there was concern that in the setting of a pandemic flu, you either wouldn't have enough eggs to manufacture vaccine, or the chickens themselves that lay the eggs would be decimated by the strain of flu. As many listeners probably know, flu vaccine is manufactured in chicken eggs. What you basically do is use a chicken egg where there's a developing yolk, a developing chicken embryo, to grow the virus, the influenza virus, and then you harvest the virus out of the chicken egg, you inactivate it, you cleave off its surface proteins, and that is basically the vaccine. But the egg is used as the incubator, as the cell medium on which the virus is grown. So as a hedge against an avian flu that would either decimate the chicken flocks around the country or overwhelm our supply of eggs, we created this strategic stockpile of chickens that was sequestered in, you know, carefully maintained facilities where if a virus started to spread on the outside, the presumption was it wouldn't come into these facilities because they were so carefully maintained. And you'd always have a supply of chicken eggs. And so we maintained that as a strategic hedge against the pandemic. So there was a lot of pandemic planning that went on. It just was focused around flu.
Now, you have another example of something you call a hardened site, which is something you think we need for future pandemic planning, I think. But the company called Amgen, so you teach us a little bit about the history of why the island of Puerto Rico has a lot of drug manufacturing. And it was really by intention. It was to provide some industry and commerce to the island. But Hurricane Maria, which I guess was that 2014, you know, really caused a major disruption in those factories that develop drugs. And yet there was one corner of the island where Amgen that makes a drug called Neupogen, which is a bone marrow stimulant that helps produce white blood cells, totally was spared. No problem at all. They continued. And you, I guess, made a call or learned from the Amgen CEO. You know, what was it? First of all, why were they spared? And then, you know, and then how did they do it?
So this was after Hurricane Maria devastated the island, as you said. I was traveling down to Puerto Rico to visit with our office down there. Fully 10% of all the drugs that are consumed in the United States are manufactured in Puerto Rico. There's a lot of concentrated pharmaceutical manufacturing. So before the trip, I called around all the pharmaceutical CEOs who had facilities in the island to basically get a status report on how badly damaged the facilities were. And they were all offline. I mean, the facilities had basic HVAC air conditioning operating to basically maintain the environment. So you didn't have, you know, the whole facility decimated with, you know, overgrowth of mildew, but they weren't able to manufacture. And then I got to Amgen and I got the CEO, Bob Bradway, on the phone. And I said, how's your facility? And he proceeded to describe the first of all, his facility was operating at full tilt. And he just proceeded to describe an extremely hardened facility. I mean, they had like generators to back up their generators. They had enough fuel on hand to operate for months off the grid. And so I asked the obvious question. I said, Bob, why'd you build this exceptionally hardened facility? And his answer was, we made an implicit guarantee to the federal government that there would never be an interruption in the supply of Neupogen, which was a drug they made there. And to fulfill that, they built excessively hardened facilities and distributed them around the country. And so the reason why was because Neupogen is used to reconstitute white blood cells, typically after chemotherapy. But if there was ever a radiological attack and people had their bone marrow poisoned by radiation, you'd also need a lot of Neupogen to help rescue people from the radiation poisoning. And so if a dirty bomb ever went off in a city, you'd all of a sudden need a lot of Neupogen. And to help fulfill that need as a strategic hedge against that contingency, the federal government paid Amgen some implicit amount of money to build these exceptional facilities. So it's an illustration of the kind of planning that needs to go into place as a hedge against the pandemic. We need to pay for some residual capacity in the system, in the current system, as it currently operates, as a strategic hedge against these contingencies. We can't just build plants and mothball them. We need to keep them hot. We need to keep them operating. And so we're going to need to pay for some level of resiliency and not just maximal efficiency. You know, maximal efficiency, the example I use is a high complexity diagnostic lab may operate 3,000 PCR machines at 80% capacity. That's maximal efficiency. You can't operate them all the time. You need some downtime. Maximal resiliency may be having 5,000 machines and operating them at 50% capacity. So now you have a surge capacity available. Well, someone's going to need to pay for that residual capacity because it's expensive to keep excess capacity on hand. Businesses operate for maximal efficiency. So that's where the government could come in and pay for some residual capacity and have a call option on it, a strategic hedge against a bad outcome like a pandemic. And we did it in the case of Neupogen because we envisioned the possibility of a dirty bomb. We haven't done it against these naturally occurring threats broadly enough.
One last question, Dr. Gottlieb. You and others, you make the case in the book and you give credit to others, call essentially for a forecasting service, like something along the lines of the National Weather Service, to use, as you say, strategic data, insight, information, intelligence to try to be more on the ball, more predictive, because it's inevitable we're going to have another pandemic. And I guess the question for you is, do you think we'll get there? Will we get there politically? Will we get there, whether it's militarily, scientifically? Will we spend the resources and the effort to get to such a place where we would be caught much less unprepared next time?
I hope we will. I mean, the book was an attempt to sort of lay out and start to stimulate that discussion about what we need to do to be better prepared and hardened against these contingencies in the future. I think that there's going to be a more fundamental debate that needs to precede the debate around how do we prepare for the next pandemic. And that is a debate around what is the role of public health. I think that in order to be properly prepared for the next pandemic, we're going to need to empower public health agencies. We're going to need to build new capacities in CDC and empower them in a way to act in a public health crisis of this magnitude in the future. And I think that there's skepticism of public health right now. I think there's people who felt that the guidance was always shifting, you know, 6 feet, 3 feet, 10 feet. What is the right distance? What's the basis for the recommendation? Do we wear masks? Do we not wear masks? What kind of masks? And so I think people have a skepticism of the public health advice that they got during the pandemic. And this isn't just sort of a right-left debate, conservative, liberal. I think it's more pervasive than that. And so we need to have a fundamental discussion about what the role of public health is. How do we reform the process by which public health advice gets generated and disseminated and then arrive at a consensus around the appropriate role for public health officials and public health agencies that it hopefully vests in them the authority that they need to exercise the role that they're going to have to play in a public health crisis. But I think that that discussion is going to have to precede the discussion around what should the CDC look like in the future, because we're not going to get a political consensus on what the CDC should look like in the future and make a more powerful, better equipped CDC unless we agree that public health officials should lead the way in a public health crisis. I certainly believe they should, but I think that there's a lot of skepticism of that proposition.
The name of the book is Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who served as the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration from 2017 to 2019 and is currently a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Scott Gottlieb is a former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. His new book is called Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We had additional help with recording this week at the Flyloft Studio from Scott Bell. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please do stay safe out there.